Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Sam, and as always, I'm so glad you could join me for a little while today as we continue to go through the big old binder of baseball cards, and we're in a brand new era of baseball cards. As we mentioned last week with the 73 top set being the final set that was released in several series by Topps, at least that's how it would be until 1993. Well, that marked the end of the vintage card era, or the classic card era, as some people will call it. 1974 brought in a new era with a single series set, but one that had a little bit of an oopsie in it, and you can still collect those mistakes today. 74 Topps, a pretty clean design, a fan favorite, a hobby favorite as well, and not just because of its design, but because of the mistakes, which we will get into in just a little bit. One of my favorite sets from the 70s, even though it wasn't jumping out at you as in terms of style and design, and it was pretty good, and I don't think it quite gets the credit that it's due, much like our random poll. Card number 220, Don Sutton. When you think of great Dodgers pitchers from the last, 50, 60 years, naturally you think of Koufax and Drysdale right off the bat. And nowadays you think of Clayton Kershaw, you think of Zach Greinke's time there before he signed on with Arizona a couple years ago. You think of Fernando Valenzuela, Oral Hershiser, but a lot of people don't think about Don Sutton, and that is a real shame because Don Sutton was one of the most consistent, professional, nasty pitchers that you could see. And a lot of people forget about that edge that he played with. He's a guy that could brush you back, and he's a guy who had a few tricks up his sleeve, not to mention the occasional emery board. But here's a guy who won 20 games just once in his career, and never had over 300 strikeouts in a season, but he was a pretty complete pitcher, spent most of his time with the LA Dodgers, but would bounce around later, finally winning a championship with the Dodgers in 1988. And you know what's funny about his career? I rattled off a whole bunch of numbers and a bunch of what-ifs. The one year that he won 20 games, he went 21-10 in 1976, yet somehow was not an all-star that year. I don't know how that happens, but we'll talk a little more about Little D, as he was known, one of many nicknames Don Sutton, our random pull from the 74 top set. Now, we got a lot to talk about. In fact, you're talking about a lot of things on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. This past week, people talking about the 73 top set, talking about some cards that they pulled out of their collections and were sharing. Also, talking a little bit about the 82 Donruss set, which was our Flashback Friday podcast featuring Larry Heisel. And even had one listener mention that he never really strayed from Topps when he was collecting in the early 80s, but it was still a pretty card, as he put it. That would be Shaw Law Offices. Thank you for chiming in. And my advice on 82 Donruss is it's still affordable, but don't go overboard because, as we discuss in the podcast, there's a lot of cut-and-paste design to 82 Donruss. So even though the Donruss set in 82 was much better than what you saw in 81, still left a lot to be desired. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to the Flashback Friday edition, just scroll through the Wax and Gum Stains timeline. You'll find the links to that from this past weekend. Also, our good buddy Stratty D, also known as Dr. Funky Butt Lovin, we'll go with the family-friendly name of Stratty D, though, actually put out a fun little 30-day baseball card challenge. Now, I've been a little busy this weekend. I haven't taken up on this yet, but maybe this is something that collectively we can do down the line here, but you've seen these things on social media before. You see it on Facebook, especially on Facebook, not necessarily Twitter. But somebody will, you know, put up, especially in November, now that I think about it, you know, 30 days of thanks. And of course, it's centered around Thanksgiving. And, you know, day one, you know, post something you're thankful for. Day two, post someone you're thankful for, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just this, you know, 30-day litany of posts that you're supposed to put out there. So the 30-day baseball card challenge also has, you know, day one, a card from the current year with a photo you like. Day two, a card with more than one player on it. Day three, a card from the first set you try to complete. And you've got all sorts of different challenges here, you know, favorite cards from different decades, your favorite parallel card based on the parallel, not the player, favorite oddball cards, favorite card from before 1950, whether you own it or not, because chances are you don't have it. And of course, the creme de la creme. Day number 30, your favorite card in your collection. And that is a tough one. It would take me probably 30 days to make that decision. But that is on the Wax and Gum Stains timeline as well. So go ahead and take a look at that. And, you know, if you want to chime in on that, go right to it. And, you know, feel free to tag us in any posts that you have with the 30-day baseball card challenge. Now, Stratty D was also pretty much involved in something that we did this past weekend. We again had another classic or vintage, if you want to call it, pack break. And we've been doing this for a few weeks, and we've had some pretty good response. I would like to get more people involved in it. And I think what happened this weekend might get a few more people involved in it. And it's very simple. You know, I'll scout around, shop around, find some vintage wax products. We found some from the early 80s. That's pretty much the one window I can afford. You know, like I said in the last podcast, a lot of the unopened wax from the mid to late 70s, which was my initial goal, they've been priced way high recently. So I just don't know if that's a spike in the market or what's going on, but we're going to see if we can get those down to a slightly better price range, because obviously people will pay good money to open that. And you get to keep the cards, by the way, in these breaks, but we just do through DM. You send us a bid. We normally have several people kind of bidding against each other. We'll close the auction after 48 hours. Highest bidder gets to keep the cards after we open them up, and I post the video on YouTube. And if you didn't get the chance to see it, we sent out the tweet a couple times yesterday. If you didn't get the chance to see it, Stratty D won the auction for two 85 Topps cello packs. Now, I don't share how much people have paid for it. I can say that he did not invest a whole lot of money, but it is, you know, kind of what the market rate is for a couple of cello packs from 85. It's several dollars. We'll leave it at that. But it's funny because when I put together that auction, initially, I was just going to do one cello pack, because we had opened up a few 83 Fleer wax packs the week before. And I said, oh, here's this cello pack with Dale Murphy on the front and Lance Parrish on the back. Well, while I'm getting the cello packs together, I see that I have a second one. I said, oh, you know, I'll put both up, you know, get some extra value here. So Stratty D won the auction. And yesterday we opened up the packs, and the first pack didn't have a whole lot in it. The Dale Murphy card, unfortunately, actually had a little damage to the lower or the bottom border. Now, that's something that, you know, you could smooth over, but that's not something that you can flip and sell. I mean, obviously, there's not exactly a hot market for 85 Topps Dale Murphy cards, but fortunately, that was the only card that was damaged. Every other card came out in mint condition. And while I'm doing the break, I get to the second pack and I say, well, law of averages, you know, you don't get much in the first pack, you're going to get something in the second pack, right? So we get a Tony Fernandez rookie card. Oh, okay, that might get you a dollar. We get an Ozzie Smith card. Oh, okay, that might get you a dollar. And then the very next card, you guessed it, the Mark McGwire rookie card. Yes, big win there for Stratty D. And just glossing over the card, it is, in my opinion, in gem mint condition. I mean, it is centered, sharp corners, no blurry corners, no fuzzy borders, no smudges of ink, no wax or gum stains on it. And, you know, again, I just kind of glossed over it because when you're holding one of those cards fresh out of the pack and it's somebody else's, you know, it's no longer mine, you bought it. You want to take extra care of it. So I put it in a top card holder, and we're going to send that along with the rest of the cards from the pack there. But congratulations, Stratty D. You definitely made your money back on that auction there. And I have seen that card ungraded go for anywhere like $10 to $15, which is a pretty good, you know, price for a card. Some people don't consider 85 part of the junk wax era, but it's close. You know, there's still a lot of product from 1985 out there, not as much as like 1990 or 91. But the 85 Topps cards, that's one of the top cards out of the whole set. So like I said, $10 to $15 is what I've seen ungraded. But if you get it professionally graded and it does come back as a 9 or a 10, which in my opinion, I think it would, then you've got a card that could be valued at several hundred, if not $1,000. So Strati D, congratulations. That will be coming in the mail very soon. And yes, we will be purchasing insurance to go with the rest of the package there. But I hope you eagerly await by your mailbox over the next few days to get that. And for those who missed out, I eagerly hope that you're involved in the next auction. Our next item up for bids, actually items, will be 382 Fleer wax packs. And if you've listened to the show for any, you know, stretch of time, you've heard me mention it. 82 Fleer is one of my least favorite sets for various reasons. You can listen to the archive version on our, you know, Audio Boom homepage if you want, or, you know, any of our pages, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher. They're all there, all the archived episodes. I'm not a big fan of the set, never have been. The one card that does save the set, though, much like every other set from 1982, is the Cal Ripken Jr. card. So you got three packs. Who knows? Maybe you get one, or you know, the way that they used to sequence those cards back in 82, you may get two or three. You have no idea, but you have to participate. And like I said, the introductory prices are pretty low for these. So I don't know yet what the introductory price is. The opening bid for this probably going to be $8, just because, again, you're getting three packs here. But let's get a few people to chime in on that and bid it up a little bit, and then we'll do the break later on. Now, as for this particular auction, I don't know if it's going to be this upcoming weekend, simply because I go on vacation this weekend, but I will decide at some point in time if we decide to move it up a few days and just do the auction a little earlier this week, or we move it back to the following weekend. But if you're interested, follow Wax and Gum Stains, and you will see the auction tweets go out several times during that 48-hour window. Also, just want to let you know, we've got some 86 Fleer Cello packs ready to go for a future auction. And I'm always keeping an eye on certain things, like I mentioned, you know, trying to get some stuff from the late 70s. But again, for whatever reason, 76 to 81, the market's gone really high. So I'm going to see if I can find a good deal out there for you. If not, we'll find some more good stuff from the early to mid 80s, I think you will like. Also, just to close the book on a question that I asked about the vending boxes, I've been able to price some vending boxes, trying to complete some sets of my own. It's a little bit of a shotgun approach, I'll admit, but it's kind of fun to open up those 500 count boxes and thumb through all the cards there. The problem is you tend to have 480 cards afterwards that you don't want. But I did ask the question, if we put a vending box of cards up there, would you want to get into a little bidding war in an auction? Didn't have a lot of responses to it, just a few people, and most everybody says if we're going to put a vending box up there, it's got to be like pre-1986. And I completely understand that, because, like I said, if you've got a box of 87 tops, even though we all love 87 tops, or most of us do, if you got a box of 87 tops, you might pull out the star cards or maybe a few cards to complete a set, but then you've got nearly 500 cards you really don't want anymore. And then you're going, okay, well, what do I do to move these out here? So, you know, it's kind of a catch-22 there. I think it's kind of fun to go through the vending box, but then after a while you're like, great, now I've got all these cards I don't want. And that was kind of the consistent basis of reaction that I got from people. Unless it's a, you know, an 83 or an 84 tops vending box, you're not going to bid on it. Now, if I do find that, just keep that in mind, if I do decide to put it up for auction, the price will be significantly higher because you've got some more significant cards in it. Plus the shipping alone, you know, it's going to cost $14 or $15 just to get it out there. But anyways, if we do find that great deal, we'll put it up there. If not, then we'll continue with the rack packs and cello packs and wax packs preferably from a time span, I'd say from like 76 to 86. We'll see what we can find for our fans out there. Now, please make sure you share the information about wax and gum stains. Share it with all of your friends, those who collect now or who collected back in the day. As I mentioned, you could talk about our podcast or the players that we feature in the podcast, or you can talk about, you know, whatever you want to talk about. Like I said, this week in particular, just a lot of random discussions going on, but that's a good thing. It's a pretty open forum there, and it's open 24/7. Tag us in any postings that you have. Tag your friends in there as well and make sure that they follow Wax and Gum Stains. Also, make sure that they know that new podcast Wax Ecstatic come out every Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock Eastern. Even though I am on vacation next week, we will post a podcast on 75 Tops on Tuesday. I'll just record it a couple days earlier, so it will come out at its usual time and we'll get the usual reaction to it. So hopefully you can join us for that one and for all future new episodes. Now, we're continuing through the binder right up through 1980, so we only have a few more weeks, and then I've got a plan. I've got an idea of where we're going to go next, and I'll float it out there, not this week, maybe a couple weeks from now. I've had some people suggest we should take the show in this direction for a little bit. I know not everybody's a fan of this direction, but I'm just curious. Like I said, we'll throw it out there in just a little bit and see how people are up for that, or if they're up for that. But anyways, the new episodes come out on Tuesdays. We've got our flashback editions on Friday and all throughout the weekend. And you can listen on Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or TuneIn, whichever your preferred platform of listening to a podcast is. It's there, not just the new episodes, but all the older episodes as well. Now let's take a look at our set for this week. 74 Tops, which, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, is one of those sets that doesn't quite get the credit it's due. It's actually a very nice set. Not the best set that Tops put out. I still think in the 70s, in particular, you're looking at 71 Tops is probably the best one, even though it's a real pain to find in gem mint condition just because of the black borders. You can make an argument that cards like 76 or 77, or some people will say 70 or 72, those are the best sets from that decade. But I think 74, if you take a second look at it, it'll move up the chart very quickly for a number of reasons. One, the design is very clean. It's simple, yet there's still a lot to like about it. It doesn't, you know, blow you away with design, but it's a pretty nice, simple design. Despite a lack of really creative photography, of course, part of that might have been a little bit of a backlash from 73 Tops, where Tops just went overboard with the action shots, and you had those goofy, overambitious wide-angle action shots. And speaking of wax and gum stains, our Twitter feed, I did post a couple of collages of some of my favorite, you know, good action shots, and then the action shots, which you do see quite a bit of. So scroll down our timeline for that. So, you know, in 74, Tops kind of dialed that back just a little bit. But other than that, pretty good overall design, which we'll get into. Plus, pretty good set of rookie cards. The big one is Dave Winfield, including both variations of Dave Winfield. We'll talk about the variations in a moment. But you also have, let's see, Ken Griffey Sr., the Snake, Dave Parker. You've got Frank Tanana, and as Red Sox fans know him, Bucky Effin Dent. His rookie card is there as well. Plus, you've got a very special subset to start off the set. Cards number 1 through 6 are career highlights to Hank Aaron, because going into the 1974 season, Hammer and Hank had 713 home runs. It was obvious that he was going to break Babe Ruth's record at some point in time. Of course, he would on April the 8th, 1974. So Topps was very eager to put together this flashback view on some of his cards. And because it's not just a Hank Aaron tribute, but also it's the first 6 cards of the set, and because kids handled cards a lot differently back then than they do now, you know, handling those lower number cards, often rubber banding them together, and a lot of wear and tear in those first few cards. So that bumps up the value just a little bit. But, you know, there's some good rookie cards, the Hank Aaron subset. You've got a lot of star cards, of course, you know, a lot of the major stars of the 1970s and 80s, including Mike Schmidt, Carlton Fisk. I mean, you name it. I mean, any good player, Pete Rose, any good player from the 70s and into the early 80s, was featured in the 74 set. It is chock full of known players. And it's a 660-card set. And as I've mentioned before, this is the first year that Topps decided to release the whole set in one series, totally breaking protocol here. And there were a couple good reasons why they did it. First of all, it just made sense financially because the series, as I've mentioned, you know, the high number series in past years, series 5, 6, or 7, a lot of people didn't buy those because a lot of stores didn't stock them. Well, you would have grocery stores that would have, you know, series 3 and 4 just hanging around all summer. They weren't going to spend a lot of money on series 5, 6, and 7. So, you know, it didn't make much sense for the retailer to sell them. Topps was starting to hurt a little bit because they weren't able to move as many high number series cards, even if they did have some kind of special insert or some kind of special bonus for those high series cards. A part of the issue too, financially, is you also had at this time, you know, in the early 70s, the NFL was starting to overtake Major League Baseball as America's prime, you know, sports league to follow. A lot of people were thinking that baseball was kind of passe. And of course, baseball was starting to go through labor pains here. They were going through the, you know, contract negotiations with the Players Association. This is right before free agency started later on in the decade. So, you know, the traditional sport of baseball was really getting upended over the previous few years here. And, you know, the times had changed. You know, people weren't just aggressively collecting cards in all series and all times of the year. So retailers were hurt by it. Topps as a wholesaler was hurt by it. So they just figured, you know what, we're just going to put all 660 cards in one series. And then there's, you know, it comes out in March and, you know, however many you need, they'll be available throughout the year. So it's basically just kind of, you know, leveling out the playing field a little bit here. One card was just as equal as the other in the sense of distribution. So that pretty much killed, you know, the high series and the higher values for the high series cards that you saw from 1973 prior. Now, another thing is, Topps had a nice little promotional tie-in with the JCPenney department store chain. In fact, the only way that you could buy the complete factory set was through the Penney's store catalog. And we've talked about this in previous podcasts. Show of hands here. How many of you, when you were kids, and of course, this means you have to be probably 35 or older. If you're a teenager or in your 20s, you really don't have much of a concept of a paper catalog that you ordered stuff through. Of course, this is pre-internet living we're talking about. But, you know, if you're my age or a little older, like I said, a few years younger, you remember, especially around Christmas time, you got that big 500-page JCPenney catalog. You flipped to the back. That's where all the toys were. And you would, you know, circle the toys you wanted for Christmas, or you'd cut them out and paste them on a piece of paper. If you had any brothers or sisters who did the same thing, you fought to get the catalog first, because once they cut things out, then whatever you wanted on the backside of a page was already cut out, and it drove you crazy. Well, that's how you had to get the complete set there. So you could purchase that entire 660-card set, or you could try to accumulate it through packs and trading and all that stuff. Well, it seemed like a perfect plan for Topps in 1974. Finally, we level things out financially. Because football was starting to overtake baseball in popularity, Topps could also stagger the release of football cards and basketball cards and hockey cards as well. Even though Topps had been making cards for all those other sports since the 1950s, you know, now they could start, you know, planning them out when they get released, so that, you know, a high series baseball card wasn't coming out when the NFL cards were coming out. So, you know, they had this perfect plan to, you know, streamline things on their end, to make a little more money on their end, to have that exclusive deal with JCPenney, and to also help other retailers who weren't stuck with just a bunch of product sitting in a storage house at the end of the season. It was such a perfect plan until the San Diego Padres screwed things up. The San Diego Padres, of course, born in 1969, one of the four expansion teams in Major League Baseball, and it was a muddied up expansion in 1969. If you didn't hear me explain the 1969 expansion process, go back a few episodes to our 69 Topps podcast, and you will get the complete history of the Major League Baseball expansion in 1969. It was goofed up in a number of ways, and it's all because of Charlie Finley moving the Kansas City Athletics to Oakland. It was all his fault, basically. You know, baseball had to rush through an expansion that they had initially planned for 1971. Well, it got moved up to 1969. They brought in four teams to even out both the American League and National League and create the division series. And, of course, it was a bomb right out the gate. You know, first of all, the Seattle Pilots lasted 1 year, got sold the, you know, a couple days before the 1970 season, moved to Milwaukee and became the Brewers. The Montreal Expos were struggling. The Kansas City Royals were in much better shape compared to the rest of the expansion teams. And the San Diego Padres were struggling as well. One of the big reasons why they were struggling, they were playing in a massive, I think it was a 65,000-seat Jack Murphy Stadium. And, you know, like any other expansion team, they're not going to win many games. And the way it worked in San Diego in the late 60s and early 70s, even though San Diego has a very rich baseball history, not just with the Pacific Coast League Padres, but all of the players who were born and raised there. I mean, you're talking, you know, Ted Williams, of course, is the biggest one, but you had a lot of other players come up in and around the San Diego area. It had a rich history, but with the Padres just bumbling things on and off the field, people just didn't show up to Padres games. So they were losing money rapidly, so rapidly that in the middle of the 1973 season, an ownership group out of Washington, D.C. had come to an agreement with the Padres ownership to buy the Padres and basically move them to Washington. Of course, the district had just lost the second Washington Senators. They moved to Texas after the 1971 season. So you had a close friend of Richard Nixon, who also ran a bank at that time. He was the main investor. He came to this agreement, and baseball wanted to make sure if they're going to move a team to Washington, D.C., the third baseball team in Washington since 1960, they wanted to make sure that everything was right. So they had a lot of conditions in there, a lot of financial conditions that had to be met. The major league owners had to agree on, okay, if the city of San Diego sues the ownership, you know, we've got their back and we're going to pool some money together to cover the cost. Well, long story short, as the summer of 73 leads to fall, things start unraveling. And never mind about the Nixon White House. No, I'm talking about this sale. As the Padres, the ownership starts hitting some rough waters. Of course, the city of San Diego is just suing the pants off of them. Some of the major league owners get cold feet because they see the number of dollars that are coming out there. And now they're not so supportive. Plus, the lead investor, he was going to start getting into trouble with the feds, actually. In fact, I think the bank would go belly up and he served prison time down the line. Some minority investors were not able to cash in. So all of a sudden, what seemed to be a sure deal at the end of the 1973 season was very much up in the air in the spring of 1974, or I should say the late winter, you know, going into January of 74. Well, Topps still has to put out a product. And now that they're releasing the whole set in one series, they've got to put everything out in advance, not only so that cards show up in wax packs in March, but those complete sets with that exclusive deal with JCPenney, well, they've got to show up at JCPenney's warehouse on time. So Topps takes a gamble. It seemed like one way or another, the move of the Padres to Washington, D.C. was going to happen. So with Padre player cards, instead of the cards saying San Diego up top on the top flag and Padres on the bottom flag, and we'll talk a little more about the design in a moment, then you had, it would say Washington in the upper flag and then National League, and National League was abbreviated, in the bottom flag. So this was the best way the Topps could get out and say, all right, these were the former San Diego Padres, the Washington whatevers. And there was, in fact, a name and a uniform. We tweeted out a picture of Dave Frieselbaum, who is a pitcher for the Padres, and he's wearing this odd-looking jersey. It's kind of a mix between the Cincinnati Reds and the Minnesota Twins. It just says Washington across the top, and it's, you know, red, white, and blue. It's kind of this light powder blue road uniform, and there is a cap with a white front, and I believe it's a red W with a little star on it, and people assume it was going to be called the Washington Stars. And that was a mock card that we sent out. Topps never actually made that card. But that picture that you see on there, there are several different versions of that picture that are still out there. You know, just type in Dave Frieselbon, Washington, in Google Images, and you'll have a whole bunch pop up there. But it was actually very interesting to see these pictures here. So, you know, you had a team name ready. You had a team uniform ready. Padres players, including Frieselbon, knew that, all right, this is going to probably happen here. I mean, I'm modeling this new uniform. Well, lo and behold, right before the 1974 season starts, once this deal is on shaky ground, in comes Ray Kroc. Kroc made a fortune in taking the McDonald Brothers milkshake concept and turning it into what we now know as McDonald's, the fast food giant. And he had made his fortune here. And keep in mind, too, San Diego had already lost an NBA team. The Houston Rockets actually started in San Diego in the early 70s. They only made it a few years there and then moved out to Houston. San Diego did not want to lose another professional team. They did not want to become a one-sport town. They would have just been left with the Chargers. So here comes Ray Kroc, a moment of civic pride here. He thinks baseball can be a big hit, and he buys the Padres. Not only buys the team, but renegotiates the lease agreement at Jack Murphy Stadium. So he's going to stay in San Diego at least through the decade. He's going to cover some of the previous debts, take care of any lawsuits, stuff like that. So the Padres are saved. Hip, hip, hooray. Yay, the Padres are saved. Well, if you're Topps, oops. The set's already gone out to press. Cards have already been put into wax packs. Sets have already been produced and shipped off to JCPenney. Stop the presses. They've got to go back and fix it up once again. So they went through and made the correction, and the San Diego Padres cards appropriately say San Diego in the top flag and Padres in the bottom flag. But that was the one goof up. It was out of Topps control, but it was the one goof up. They took a gamble and they lost big time. But again, you know, in the late summer, early fall of 1973, it seemed like a given thing. All right, you know, baseball is just not working in San Diego. We're going to move this team to Washington. We'll give Washington, D.C. one more chance. And it didn't work out. So Topps gets burned. They have to release a corrected version. And there are two different variations of every Padres card out there. So the Padres cards that say Washington and National League are valued a little higher than the typical San Diego Padres cards simply because there are fewer of them out there. But there's still plenty of them out there. It's not that hard to find them. Like I said, the press was already done. Sets were already produced. Packs were already made. They were already shipped. They were out of Topps' hands. So then they had to go back to the drawing board and revise all of the San Diego cards. So there's a handful, I believe it's 16 or maybe 18 cards that have the San Diego and Washington variation. Now, other than that goof up, like I said, the 74 Topps card's actually pretty nice. Let's take a look at our random pull card number 220 featuring Dodgers pitcher Don Sutton. We look at the front of the card, and you have, you know, a lot of white space. Yes, there's a lot of border. I know some people really don't like that, but it's a very simple space here, and the space is used for the team name, the position, and the player's name. That's it. You still have about 80% of the card devoted to a nice square picture. Now, as I said before, the action shots were dialed back a little bit, so you get more of the standard static posed shots, and here you have Don Sutton. Looks like he's at spring training in Vero Beach, just kind of milling about one of the fields at Dodger Town. But you have that big square. In this case, it's a pink square. Now, the color variations would change throughout the different cards. But with this card, the Dodgers had a pink square and then the blue flags. The top flag would have the city name of the team. The bottom flag had the name of the team. So Los Angeles on top, Dodgers on bottom. Same thing with San Francisco on top, Giants on bottom, Boston on top, Red Sox on bottom. You get it. Next to the city name was the player's position, in this case, a pitcher. And at the bottom, next to the team name, you had the player's name, in this case, Don Sutton. Very simple, very clean. Even with all the white space, it still works out. Like I said, there's a lot of space on here, and it does detract in the minds of some collectors. But I think overall, it's a pretty good, clean, classic look. You know, anytime you can throw a flag up there or something that just has that baseball feel. It looks good. Now, does it look as good as the 65 Topps set with the little mini pennant? No, I don't think so. I'm always a huge fan of 65 Topps. But I think it looks better than what you would see in 1980, where Topps used almost the same design here, where they had a lot of white space, a rectangular picture, and instead of the little flags at the top and bottom, the flags kind of turned into sashes, you know, kind of wrapping around the picture. That was a little tacky. I think 74 Topps is very clean. I don't want to say businesslike, but it's pretty sharp. It's actually very sharp, and there are a lot of sharp cards here. Even though they dialed back some of the action photos, I know just through my own collection, you know, Pete Rose in action at the plate. You've got Carlton Fisk in action at the plate. Bill Fahey, too. That's another, you know, a common card here, but, you know, it's a horizontal card of him making a play at the plate. So, you know, some pretty decent cards on a pretty sharp, simple layout. It's almost like, you know, you had Gaudy in 72, they cleaned it up in 73. Well, 74, they definitely cleaned it up with a very simple, conservative look, which would get turned on its ear in 75, as we'll discuss next week. Let's turn the card over. A very simple design on the back here. The only drawback is the selection of colors, in my opinion, a little hard to read. Not as bad as 72 Topps, but still a little hard to read in the sense that you've got a dark green background and black text. And what makes it really hard to read is the gray cardstock, too. So it's not all that different from 71 or 67. 67 popped a little more, the avocado green. This isn't quite avocado green. It's definitely a 70s green. You did see this color a lot in the 70s. But it is a little hard to read, especially if you've got players that have, you know, 15, 16 years of stats there. It's very difficult to pick it out there. Topps, by the way, going with just the major league records then, and that's because they devoted a lot of space to superlatives from the player's career, in this case of Don Sutton, Rookie of the Year. Or Rookie Pitcher of the Year in 1966, leading the National League in shutouts in 1972, also two scoreless innings in the 72 All-Star Game. Plus, you've got the cartoon in the lower right-hand corner. And also, along the top, you not only have the card number and the player's name, Donald Howard Sutton, but you also have this faux autograph in the upper right-hand corner, which was kind of neat. And you would see the faux autograph in a lot of Topps cards in the 1970s, and in fact, going into the early 80s, that was something that they utilized quite a bit. So if you couldn't get the real Don Sutton autograph, at least you had the facsimile on the back. Now, even though it is a little difficult to read, I've always thought this was a pretty creative way of jamming a lot of information onto a 2.5-inch by 3.5-inch baseball card back. You've got complete major league stats. You've got, you know, two or three bullet points on what the player's done in his career. You've got his personal information. And then you've got the little cartoon in the bottom with another tidbit. And then you've got the faux autograph as well. So there's a lot of information jammed on here. Too bad it's a little hard to read in some cases, but overall, I like the design. I like the color selection, even though it is hard to read, and I think it matches the front of the card real well. So, as I've said, the 74 Topps set is a very popular set and one that I like. I know some collectors don't like it, again, because of the heavy usage of the white border on the front of the card, but you find a lot of collectors like it for its simple look. It's very clean design. Also, though, the selection of cards. Like I said, you've got the Winfield rookie card. You've got the Parker rookie card. You've got a lot of young star cards in here. Guys that would become major stars in the 70s and 80s are found in this set. And you also have the Hank Aaron timeline checklist, cards number 1 through 6, but also the San Diego Padre variations. And a lot of people like those cards. So for various factors, people like this set. And another factor is the fact that it came out in one series. So even though it became a headache for Topps because they had to go back and fix up the Padres cards, collectors like it because you're not looking and you're not dealing with an endless search for cards, say 500 through 660, because those are higher sets or higher series. You had one series, one set, 660 cards. It's a lot easier to assemble this set as opposed to, you know, even 73 or 72 Topps. You know, there's plenty of cards still out there for both of those. But again, with the limited quantity of high series sets that are out there, it's harder to pull those cards together to complete your own set. Not the case in 74, and that wouldn't be the case for many years afterwards, as Topps stuck with the one series system through the 1992 set. Now, as for Don Sutton, I mentioned this at the start of the show here. This is a guy that unfortunately goes under the radar a lot. He played 23 seasons in Major League Baseball and was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1998. You may not realize that. He made it there on the fifth ballot, and, well, why did he make it there? Because he was pretty darn good. 324 wins to 256 losses, an earned run average of 3.26, over 3,500 strikeouts. Now, again, Don Sutton had only one 20-win season. He never had more than 300 strikeouts, so he doesn't quite fall into the line of Nolan Ryan or even Koufax or Drysdale or who else, Roger Clemens, you know, all those bigger strikeout guys, Doc Gooden, that, you know, people from his era that you recognize. But he was one of the most consistent pitchers throughout his career. In fact, if you go to baseballreference.com, you look up the 162-game average, 14-11 record, 3.26 earned run average, and a guy who's still, on average, 159 strikeouts to 60 walks. So here is a guy who had pretty much a 4-to-1 strikeout to walk ratio. If he wasn't on some iffy teams later in his career, in particular, the Milwaukee Brewers, the Houston Astros, when they were sliding back a little bit in the early 80s, he was still one of their best pitchers. But he didn't quite have the tools around him like he did when he was in Los Angeles throughout the late 60s and early 70s. Had he been on some better teams, then you may see that overall win-loss record and the win-loss average, it would look a lot better than it is. But he was a very consistent player. I joked earlier, you know, that 21-win season, he wasn't even named to the All-Star team, and I'm still scratching my head over that. He did finish third in the Cy Young voting that year, however, and a distant 22nd in the MVP voting. He was a four-time All-Star. His first All-Star appearance, 1972, as it's mentioned on the back of this card. But Don Sutton grabbed everybody's attention in 1966. He quite literally came out of nowhere, born in Clio, Alabama. That's near the Alabama-Florida border. He grew up just outside of Panama City, and he was a standout high school pitcher in Panama City. He wanted to go to the University of Florida, but for whatever reason, the Gators didn't want him. So he went to a local community college for a year. The Dodgers scout him, they love him, and they sign him. And he becomes the young ace in the hole during the 1966 season, his rookie season. He had 209 strikeouts in 35 starts in 1966. That's the most strikeouts for a rookie pitcher since Grover Cleveland Alexander in 1911. So Don Sutton took the world by storm and provided a very nice transition from Big D, Don Drysdale, and Sandy Koufax, who were wrapping up their careers with the Dodgers. Now, Sutton would get injured late in the 1966 season, couldn't pitch in the World Series. Perhaps the World Series plays out a little differently with Sutton in the rotation and the Orioles behind, you know, the great relief appearance of Mo Dorbowski and other players wouldn't have swept the Dodgers. Like I said, you may have gotten a different story out of that World Series. But even though the Dodgers didn't win that World Series, they would be consistent players in the postseason. Of course, making the World Series in 1973, as well as 1977 and 78. But for whatever reason, they couldn't win those World Series. And Don Sutton was snake-bitten, even though he actually had some pretty good playoff performances, especially the 74 and 77 World Series. He just wasn't able to latch on to one of those teams that won a World Series, including the one in 1981, because Sutton became a free agent after the 1980 season, and he signed with the Houston Astros. Of course, as fate would have it, the Dodgers would win the World Series in 81. The Astros, despite a pretty decent season from Sutton, as he went 11-9 with a 2.61 earned run average, the Astros weren't able to repeat what they nearly pulled off in 1980 when they took the Philadelphia Phillies pretty deep in the playoffs, ultimately losing to the eventual world champions. Well, things don't go well enough in Houston for Don Sutton as he was traded to the Milwaukee Brewers, the Brewers making a playoff push in 1982. So the Brewers sent Kevin Bass, Frank DePino, and Mike Madden to Houston in the deal. Of course, Kevin Bass had a pretty decent career in Houston. And Don Sutton is once again pitching in the World Series. But the Brewers, of course, lose the series in seven games to the St. Louis Cardinals. And things go downhill a little bit in Milwaukee once again. They were still a contending team, but they just weren't as good as the Baltimore Orioles or the Detroit Tigers were in future seasons. Rocky 83 season for Sutton as he went 8-13, in fact, posted his highest earned run average at the time of 4.08, and a so-so 84 season where he went 14-12 with 3.77 earned run average. So we're swinging into 1985. He is traded from Milwaukee to Oakland for minor leaguer Eric Berry and pitcher Ray Burris, plus a minor leaguer Ed Meyers, who was the ubiquitous player to be named later in the deal. And in 1984, he is with the Oakland Athletics, goes 13-8. So he starts the 85 season with the Athletics, but is then traded to the Angels, who are making a push late in the 85 season for a player to be named later. The Angels send Bob Schrapnack and Jerome Nelson, two career minor leaguers, back to Oakland to complete the trade. Now, he re-signs with the Angels as a free agent, wins his 300th game with the California Angels, comes back to Los Angeles in 1988 as a free agent. The return doesn't go extremely well, however, as he goes 3-6 in 16 starts. The Dodgers need an upgrade on the pitching mound because, you know, they're playing for a World Series here. So he remains with the Dodger organization and basically wins a ring de facto with the Dodgers defeating the A's in five games in 1988. After his playing career, he stepped right into broadcasting and has been broadcasting a lot since then. Is currently a radio announcer with the Atlanta Braves broadcast group and was also with the Washington Nationals for several years prior to that. But he had some roots with the Braves back in the late 80s and early 90s. So he's gone back and forth between Atlanta and Washington and has been with Atlanta for the last several years, doing color analysis on the radio. His son, by the way, used to work for the Arizona Diamondbacks as a broadcaster, too. So it's not just baseball that runs in the Sutton family, but also the broadcasting bug has bitten quite a few Suttons as well. And one of my favorite revelations that I have picked up about Don Sutton, he really got his broadcasting career started in the 70s when he was in Los Angeles as a panelist on the original Match Game. Yeah, with Gene Rayburn as host and all sorts of interesting guests from 1970s Hollywood. So, yeah, if you watch the old Match Game, I think Game Show Network still airs it, or you could probably just find it on YouTube. You will find in a couple of episodes Don Sutton talking about how dumb Dora really is. I mentioned he is a Baseball Hall of Famer. He is a little under the radar, although he did have a nasty edge to him. Don Drysdale was called Big D. Don Sutton was called Little D. And even though he was a very devout Christian, and I'm assuming he still is a very devout Baptist, he was nicknamed Elmer Gantry by his Dodger teammates in the late 60s. Elmer Gantry, of course, the title character of a Sinclair Lewis book from 1927, where Gantry was a holier-than-thou priest who had a little bit of a steamy side to him. Sutton could do the same thing, even though he was, for lack of a better term, and no offense to anybody who is, you know, a devout Christian, a Bible thumper, and this, you know, he had a very ultra-religious background, which a lot of the baseball players in the 60s didn't. Even though he had that working for him, he's somebody who, like I said, could doctor up the baseball every now and then, could brush you back as well, had a little bit of a nasty edge to him. So let's just put it this way. Don Sutton wasn't a saint, but he was certainly pitching from a higher power and does not quite get the credit that I think he deserves, because he was a heck of a ball player and I think needs a little more appreciation for what he did. Of course, he's in the Hall of Fame, so I don't know what more you need, but I think as time has gone on, people have just kind of let the name Don Sutton fall through the cracks a little bit, unless you're a Dodger fan or, you know, you saw him win that 300th game, or you were a Brewers fan when they made that run in 1982. I think a lot more attention needs to be put on Don Sutton and his career. So there you go. Little D, or Elmer Gantry, Don Sutton, card number 220 from the 1974 Topps set. A favorite of mine, a favorite of a lot of collectors for many reasons, be it the design, be it the rookies, be it the Hank Aaron tribute, or be it the goofed up Washington National League cards, better known as the San Diego Padres. And poor Ray Kroc would never fully see the return on his investment as he died in the winter of 1984. But then the Padres went on a miraculous World Series run that year, falling to the Tigers. But the Kroc family owned the Padres for a very long time and still continue to give to the San Diego area. And also a lot of national arts programs. You hear about the Ray and Joan Kroc Foundation. They're very big if you're a big fan of National Public Radio or PBS television. Very big donations given from the Kroc Foundation to both of those organizations. So there you go. A pretty fun set and an underrated set, but an underrated player to boot that we pulled from it. You're more than welcome to talk about it on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And of course, you could talk about anything else you want to talk about, and keep an eye out for our Flashback Friday episode this upcoming weekend and our next auction, the 382 Fleer packs. We'll either do it a little earlier this week or the following weekend when I'm back in town from vacation. Again, despite my vacation, there will be a new episode focusing on the colorful, to put it nicely, 75 top set. That will be coming your way next Tuesday via Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and tune in. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for listening to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.